Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic classroom lectures in business and economics recorded for podcast. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2010. Lecture 21, delivered on April 15, 2010. The title of this lecture is Equity.
Today, equity. Equity is a fancy word for ownership. Now, in the ownership of a corporation, you're claim is residual. You have, as an owner of the corporation, a claim to cash flow residual to the claims of the debt holders and, of course, the government. So at the end of the day, if there is anything left in the bank after the debt holders have been satisfied in a timely manner, and after the government has been satisfied in a timely and outrageous manner, you have what is left for you. Now, the company, as I've already pointed out, can do one of two things with the residual. It can either provide it to its shareholders as a dividend, or it can plow it back into the company as reinvestment. If it goes to you as an owner as a dividend, you are then responsible for figuring out what to do with that money. You might choose to go to Denny's, or you might choose to invest in that dividend in something a little more productive than a grand slam. If the company puts that money back into operations, theoretically, ideally, that will cause the company's value to go up because future expected cash flows will increase, which will increase the value of the company now, which will increase the price of the stock. So the trade-off is this for a shareholder. You will get a yield on your dividend, the dividend divided by the current price of the stock. You will also, or otherwise, get a capital gain if the stock appreciates in value. So you as a shareholder have two sources of gain from a corporation, and they are to some extent a trade-off. To the extent that you want a dividend, you as a shareholder are deciding that you don't want capital gains. So, and I've talked about dividends before and why there would be a dividend to begin with, because you see, if a corporation pays you a dividend, it pays it after taxes. So that is an after-tax payment to you. Then you pay on that dividend your tax. So it's double taxed. So there's almost, it seems illogical for dividends to exist, but they do, and most likely they exist as a signal to the shareholders that the company can afford to give you something, notwithstanding its potential to use that something to benefit you later more. Okay, now, I do know that in accounting classes they do talk a little about stock. Am I correct about that? And they touch upon it, how you recognize it in your financial statements, and I don't want to go through that again with you. But for the purposes of this class, we'll just make it simple. When I say stock, I could be talking about preferred stock or common stock. Preferred stock, we tend to, it truly is equity because it exists forever, but it's not like common stock. Preferred stock is almost like a hybrid between a bond and a common stock. So I'm going to set preferred stock off here to the side and talk about common stock. But common stock is not all stock. Commons, that's not the end of the discussion. As the book points out, some companies have different classes of common stock. For example, you can, is it Google and GM and companies like that, they have an insider's common stock. It has super voting rights. The case of Google, Google has this insider class of stock for the founders and for executives who, and that has 10 votes per share. 10 votes per share. And then the regular stock that you would be able to buy has one vote per share, which ensures that you are never going to have a say in that corporation, even though you get to vote on issues. These are corporations that are extraordinarily, forgive my terminology, they're afraid of democratizing their ownership. They want to make sure that the founder's vision is there. They want to make sure that the executive's decisions are never questioned materially in a vote of the shareholders. In my judgment, and I'm putting this is actually opinion, you're a fool to vote for, to buy company stock in companies like those. You are a damn fool. Because those companies are going to do whatever the hell they want. And there is never going to be a time when you can have anything to say about it except through the regulatory environment. And that has been a failure in too many ways for too long. Now, having gotten that opinion off to the side, I'm going to tell you about starting a corporation as a public corporation. This is what I did as a consultant. I started in the late 80s. I briefly ran a penny stock house. And then when I was shut down, I actually volunteered to shut down my penny stock house because it was either that or I was going to be some hard-timer's old lady. And it wasn't anything I had done. It was just a scandal in this penny stock market in Ohio, and they wanted to clear it out. The politicians decided they'd show how tough they were by wiping out the penny stock houses in Ohio. I had opened my doors the day before, and I got a call from the Ohio Division of Securities, and they told me that I could either voluntarily surrender my license in a fax to them, or they would have deputy sheriffs bust down my doors as they did in a ridiculously stupid raid on another penny stock house about 3 days before. So I shut down my house. At that point, because I had all of the framework, I began to do securities consulting. And at this time, I can say this because the statute of limitations is out. I practiced law without a license. And in fact, I was so good at it that my name got quite well known, and it got to the point where I was doing rainmaking and setting up the forms for companies, very small companies, to go public. In the end, I quit this work because the legal environment was getting rougher. It was actually, they were hunting me like a dog because I was practicing securities law without a license. And even though I tried to hide what I was doing by having lawyers sign off on what I was doing to make it look like theirs, some regulators in some states knew what was going on. And I was involved with some of the roughest people you could imagine. Rainmaking. When you're trying to get money, I'm not going to go to you, you see. I found that out pretty early. I'm not going to go to you. I'm not going to go to your dad, your mom. I'm going to go to where the money is. And where do you suppose the money is when you work out of Coral Gables, Florida? Okay, I'll let you speculate on that. I got out of the business because it was either get out of the business or be in prison or be dead. And being dead would not be a particularly enjoyable experience. The death would have been okay. It was just getting there. They had some rather aggressive methods. And so I sit here in this happy place in academia, and I can tell you how you go public. And see, usually these companies were already formed. The trick that we used in my day was what was called a reverse shell merger. A public company that had already been qualified as a public company by the SEC had died years before, but it was still in existence legally, and it was still listed on the pink sheets as a company. So what we would do is we'd take a private company and we would reverse merge it into this dead public shell, and the private company would emerge as a public company without all of the scrutiny of the SEC that would have been required if we had gone public the clean way. That was how we did it. And then I would get the listing back upgraded from pink sheets back into the OTC, NASD, and eventually, in a couple of cases, onto the AMEX. And we would get the money so that they could do a secondary public offering to get the money to do whatever it was that they were going to do. In most cases, these companies were run by phonies and liars and crooks. In a few cases, it was awesome. There really was great stuff going on. In every case where there was something great going on, ultimately, that was the companies that the Securities and Exchange Commission and the states came down on. Destroyed the people, sent them to prison, and the technologies disappeared, only to show up 5 to 10 years later as new and improved in some existing company. Funny how that worked. But anyway, let's start from the beginning. Let's start with a company. Forms by the filing of the Articles of Incorporation with the Secretary of State of the State of Incorporation. I usually use Delaware. Delaware was good. There are other states that are good too, but I like Delaware. I always thought about incorporating a company in Hawaii just because then we could have the board of directors meeting in Hawaii, but never did get around to that. But here's how we go. The Articles of Incorporation are filed with the Secretary of State. Provided that they are in order, the Secretary of State of the State of Incorporation qualifies those Articles of Incorporation and sends you back one of the copies stamped and signed. Remember that the Secretary of State of the State of Incorporation does not approve your corporate filing. It merely qualifies it. Once qualified, you are no longer the business. The corporation stands as a separate entity under the law. It is a person. Notwithstanding the shock of liberals and leftists who scream, corporations shouldn't be persons, yes, they are. Should they have the rights of human citizens? Absolutely not. And that's where our Supreme Court is damnable for its recent decisions in that regard. However, they do have legal status as persons. Buttressed by a filing that you will do with the federal government for an FEIN, the Federal Employer Identification Number, which essentially is like the Social Security number for a company. As a legal entity, the shareholders, the owners, are separated from the liabilities of the corporation. As I showed you before, in accounting they talk about this total assets equals liabilities plus owner's equity. And I pointed out to you that that is structurally meaningful in its orthographic form. There is a wall between the liabilities of the corporation and the owners. The price you pay for that is that, in theory, the owners should not be involved in the management of the corporation. That is a theoretical ideal, and it's awful that it has been moved aside in many ways. The owners should bring forth a board of directors to represent their interests. The board of directors represents the agency of the principals, who are the shareholders. Remember I talked about agency? This is why I talked about it on Tuesday. That agency relationship, by the definition of corporation, must be fiduciary. Because in the theory of a corporation, again, the owners are supposed to be separated from the management. So that would mean that the management and the board of directors that hires the management, the executive management, would not be allowed to let the shareholders affect those decisions on the day-to-day or even the larger tactical managerial level. That's what I meant by that fiduciary duty. Remember, it's a fiduciary duty if there's some fundamental defect in the ability of the principals to monitor and enforce. Well, that's what's going on here. At least in theory, there is a legal defect that is permanent, persistent, in the shareholder's ability, the principal's ability, to oversee what the management does. It is the wall of separation of ownership from liabilities. And I know this is actually, you probably already appreciate it. There's a lot of depth going on in this lecture. That people who buy stocks, they don't really grasp what it means. Well, I bought some stock yesterday. Ha, ha, ha. Do you know what you did? You became an owner of a corporation. You became a principal of a corporation. Mutual funds, ETFs, and those kinds of things, they blur that line in your the requirement that investors understand that. But at the end of the day, you are the owners. Your interests are represented as principals through the agency of the board of directors, who are a combination of owners and outsiders. The structure of the corporation and how the board of directors is arranged is oftentimes in part traditional, but also in part customized to the corporation. Now, I wrote a number of these in my time as a consultant. These are called the bylaws. The bylaws set forth the rules, the executive level management, the board of directors, what each board's responsibilities are, title is, all of that kind of stuff. The bylaws can be a large document. I patterned the bylaws I wrote on bylaws that were written in the 1930s, 1940s, and 1950s. They were large documents. They were guiding lights so that there was no question that would come up in a board meeting that would not have an answer or at least an indication of an answer. Who's responsible for doing this? Who's responsible for doing that? How do we appoint a successor CEO to the company? What are the rules by which we do that? And then the parliamentarian in the board meetings would be able to enforce the behavior of the board with respect to the matters on the table. This is another thing that is lost, not just our bylaws, just like standard stamped out documents these days, but also the power of rules of order has been lost. I know that some of you, have any of you ever been exposed to rules of order in that? Was it through a club that you belonged to or something like that? Okay, that you would not believe, rules of order, they sound so arcane and they get so complicated, but boy, they make sure that the rights of the will of the majority is enforced, but the rights of the minority are ensured. And I don't know if that's how it was said to you, but that's the way it was sort of that way. But anyway, the bylaws govern. Okay, this company will have a board of directors. There will be a president of the board. There will be a treasurer, a vice president, a vice treasurer, secretary of the board of directors. It lays out the structure of the board, how the elections are held, all that kind of stuff. And then from there also, it will also probably give indications of, is the president the CEO of the corporation, or is the CEO an executive-level management position separate from the president of the corporation and all that kind of stuff? Like I said, it's highly customized depending upon what kind of a corporation you have. But the duties are laid out. The names of the board members and the titles of the board members, the responsibilities, how many board members there will be, and then in a good set of bylaws, the means by which the executive management is put into place to ensure, as their agency relationship to the principals is as well maintained as possible. And there's the next problem. How can it be that if the board of directors acts as the agency of the shareholders, that we can have corporations that are dying, and yet they are having their executives paid obscene and continuing salaries of such awesome proportions. You see, the agency dilemma is coming through. You see, a CEO of a corporation that has fallen on its fat ass, its shareholders have lost huge value. Why, in a world where the fiduciary duty of the board members was ensured, could we have a situation like that? Instead of full accountability, firing his ass, prosecuting him if we could, making him a public example, we reward these people and we cut out workers who were the ones who were managing to keep the company going. Excuse me, I just farted. Early in the life of a corporation, there's this thing called money that we need. Now, as a consultant, a phone call might come in like this. Hi, my name is Mr. Smith. Now, I got your name from Mr. Partial. Now, Mr. Partial suggested that I talk to you because you know some places where I could get some money for my corporation. Okay, what kind of a corporation is it? And he'd start to tell me all their hopes and dreams. I said, I don't want to know about that. I want to know what the structure of the corporation is. Has it been formed? Do you have board of directors and all of that? If you don't, then I'm going to charge you more to put that stuff together for you. And then we're going to get everything in order, and then we're going to go out and we're going to do an IPO, an initial public offering of common stock. Now, there are two ways that a company can go public. There are many corporations that have stock that was given to the founders when the corporation was formed. The corporation might authorize in its articles of incorporation 100 million shares, and right now three owners have 1 million shares each, and two others have 500,000 shares each. Okay, so what we need to do is go out there and sell stock. We do not want to sell so much stock that we are going to dilute the insiders below 50%. Unfortunately, if I have to go to the venture capital sons of bitches, that's out the window. They're going to take over the corporation, and the insiders are going to have little tiny bits of stock when it's all over. But that's another story. Okay, now, again, there are two ways that a company could go public. If there is stock that already exists in the corporation, what I might do is say, all right, we're going to file Form 10. It's a registration, and I'm being a little loose here, it's a registration of the existing stock. We inform the SEC this corporation's stock is now subject to the disclosures of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. The Securities Exchange Act of 1934. It is a big form. It is essentially going public, but the stock is already in existence. We spread out the entire life of the corporation. These are the financial statements. We have now had them audited. These are the opinions of the auditors. This is the opinion of the attorneys with respect to the quality of with respect to the security and the issuance of the security. We go through all these disclosures of Form 10. It is the registration statement. Form 10. And once qualified by the SEC, and again, the SEC does not approve anything. It will qualify it. Once Form 10 is qualified by the SEC, that stock that I have disclosed in Form 10 and is subject to continuing disclosure is now able to be listed on public exchanges. Can the insiders now go out and sell their stock anytime they want? Absolutely not. because of what is called Rule 144. Insiders and also others are rules too. But essentially, insider stock that has been given to them is restricted. And it takes the opinion of an attorney, opinion of legal counsel, for that stock to be leaked out, to be released from Rule 144 over time. In other words, you as an owner who had 5 million shares, and I have put those 5 million shares as part of a registration statement on Form 10, as soon as it's qualified, you can't go out there and sell that stock. First, I have to get your company listed somewhere, and it's probably going to be on some dog exchange like the OTC, the over-the-counter. And then from there, it's going to take me a while for you to get, for me to find an attorney who's going to sign off on it. I mean, you're going to have to write him a check, and then I'm going to tell him exactly what he says, and then he's going to say that, and then you're going to sell a little bit of your stock. A couple of my clients just went crazy, and they just sold and sold and sold. It was amazing to me that the SEC never cracked down on them. But, I mean, technically, don't try to do that yourself, noob. You will get caught. You and I, we're the kind who get caught. Okay. But anyway, that's Form 10. Now, here's what happens. Form 10 is the initial exposure, disclosure of the corporation. And the way I explain this, I've had some people say, well, you shouldn't tell it like that. And other people say, well, this is exactly what it is. I'd never thought of it that way. But you see, after you have filed Form 10, for the rest of eternity, unless the company goes private again, you've gone public, by the way, in Form 10. As long as you stay public, you are subject to the requirements of the Securities Exchange Act of 1933, not just with respect to the trading of stock and the Rule 144 and all that. You are also subject to the restrictions, to the requirements of continuing disclosures. So every 3 months, you must file an amendment to your original Form 10 called your Form 10-Q. It is a quarterly update of the information of the corporation. Every quarter, you will file a Form 10-Q. And then at the every year, you will also file a Form 10-K, which is the annual. We call these the Q's and K's, and that was one of my specialties, was preparing the Q's and K's. There has been, for an amazingly long time, an electronic system that you file these through with the Securities and Exchange Commission. And does anyone know what that electronic system is called? It's called EDGAR. And I was an EDGAR filing agent. It was really weird because the way EDGAR works, now, in the old days, real long time ago, we filed these paper forms. And then it switched over. There was this gradual transition to the point where everything was filed electronically. Essentially, the way EDGAR works, if you've ever seen HTML, hypertext markup language, it works with tags, an opening tag, a closing tag. That's how this worked. Title. It was called SGML. You'd have a title tag, then Form 10-Q. Then a date tag, and then a closed date tag, and inside there you'd have this. So that you set up these documents this way. It was tedious and time-consuming if you didn't know how to automate it. But you file them on this. And then those automatically go into a public database at the SEC called the EDGAR database. And you can go as any person out there and see any Q, any K of any corporation that is public and is subject to filing requirements under the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. That is all there. Now, these forms include several important parts. One is the financials. Those will be in there. If it's a quarterly, there'll be the unaudited financials for that quarter, for the most current quarter. If it is the annuals, they will be the audited financial statements of the corporation. But I point out that there is far more to these Q's and K's, especially to the K's, than just the financials. They're one hugely important section. They'll have who owns the inside stock, who the big dogs are. All that's in there. And also, there's a wonderful section which used to be highly fun to write. It was called the MD&A, the Management Discussion and Analysis. It is a required disclosure by management of what the hell is going on in the corporation. If you want the real inside story, and of course they're going to couch it in language that legalistic language, but oh, it's just like you see the SWAT. You see all of the interesting little tidbits in there in the MD&A. Now, in my time, we had a big war that happened. The Securities and Exchange Commission was soliciting opinions. There was a movement in the 80s in contract law for plain language. That went into securities disclosure law regulations in the 1990s. And the SEC solicited opinions on whether the Securities and Exchange Commission should require, instead of the formal legalistic language in these disclosures, plain language. I, believe it or not, I actually fought against plain language. The reason is I didn't want hillbillies and their cousins buying stock. I wanted to scare them off because I'd had too many corporations where hillbillies and their cousins did own stock and they came to shareholders meeting chewing tobacco and farting. I don't understand what's going on in this corporation, but I know this. I haven't made a damn dime off that. Oh, shut up, you old. Anyway, you know, I don't want those kinds of ignorant imbeciles being able to read my financial statements, being able to read my MD&A. Unfortunately, my side lost. So, whatever. They're plain language now. But they're still quite interesting to read. And so if you're doing research on corporations, which every one of you will do in your business courses, go to Edgar. Just type in a search engine, Edgar. You'll go right to Edgar. You can find companies by their name, by their trading symbol, by their CIK. And if you go back far enough, you'll find filings I did. Of course, the corporations that made it pretend that I never existed. My filings are still there after all these years. Now, by the way, there are other things. When you go to the Edgar, you're going to see 10Q, 10K, 10Q. You're also going to see a lot of other documents that are filed through the Edgar system, like the AR. The annual report will be there. You don't have to go to the company. You can go to Edgar and find annual reports for any company. You'll find all kinds of other very informative documents. Here's one that's very interesting. The Form 8K. Now, the Form 8K is for non-recurring events. Whenever something unusual happens, a Form 8K, out of the ordinary course of business, a Form 8K has to be filed. I filed Form 8K, charged $40 a filing, whatever these companies that I was doing were hyping with a press release. They do a press release, I'd file a Form 8K, charge them $40 for it. Of course, the company didn't really have anything to say in their press releases. They were just trying to pump and dump their stock. But for of other things that can happen in a Form 8K, if, for example, one of the executive officers of the company dies, that would be a subject of a filing of an 8K. Some significant event, a large factory burns down, a Form 8K probably would be filed. So these 8Ks give you the inside deals very quickly. And in this is essentially these 8Ks, the financial news media, watch these 8Ks filings. That's where they get their best information because these companies are very glib. This is what happened. And it can be some pretty interesting stuff in some cases where corporate presidents of corporations have died under unusual circumstances, or there have been firings of the executive management, or there are just all kinds of things. The 8K is sort of like a catch-all for the unusual, non-recurring, unexpected, shall we say, events of the corporation. You would not believe how much in one place you can get. On the internet, you can just go to Edgar, and all this information is there. One place, financials, and they're formatted to a certain extent, if you know how to do it, so that you can just move those right into Excel spreadsheets and go, and do your ratio analysis and all that. It's actually a great place, and I still use it to this day as my most as my primary way for researching corporations. Before I go out there and do any other research, I hit EDGAR. For one thing, because I was familiar with it from the time it was a baby, but also because I know to this day that a lot of corporations, they don't screw around in EDGAR. Now, in my time, I was removed as consultant to corporations because of things that I disclosed, and I would explain to the, I can't lie here. I can fashion the truth, shall we say, but I can't lie to the SEC because the SEC will come and kick my ass. Because when the SEC finds that there's a lie, what you're going to say is the consultant did that. So I can't lie. So they'd fire me sometimes. But I know for a fact that these are a good place to start. Now, in after the crises that occurred about a decade or so ago, a law was passed called Sarbanes-Oxley. We call it SOX. I call it the Attorney and Accountant Employment Assurance Act, because it really doesn't do much of anything except make it so that the officers and directors of a corporation have to sign off and have personal liability for disclosures. And that was in the wake of some of the disasters like Enron, that Sarbanes-Oxley was passed so that there is essentially a personal jeopardy attaches to the fiduciary duties of the executive level management of a company. And again, really all it does is just make for more paperwork that only lawyers and accountants are allowed to do. It's huge. These kinds of legislation, they sound like everyone's getting tough on something. I mean, there was nothing in SOX that good attorneys and consultants and accountants would not have insisted upon anyway. Your management in some corporations are going to lie. They're going to do everything they can to try to hide dirty dealing. If you're a decent lawyer, if you're a decent accountant, if you're following the law, you're going to blow them out of the water anyway. Unfortunately, SOX just gets in the way and adds one more layer of bureaucracy. And that was an opinion. Now, here's the other way that you can go public. Here's the other way. This would be an initial public offering of common stock. In this one, the company is raising money by selling stock to the public. Now, in an IPO, there are different ways that a company can go public this way with an IPO. There are exemptions from the huge industrial strength requirement for small offerings. For example, one of my favorite for companies that needed less than $1 million, we did what was called a Reg D 504. It allowed me, for one thing, to not have to do filings with the federal government. Not say, well, we're going to raise money through a sale of stock. I'd normally have to. But I still have to register in the state in which I would want to sell the stock, but there would be a uniform disclosure statement that I would be able to use for many of the states. Some of the states were total assholes. They had their own requirements and all of that. But a lot of the states, there was a uniform disclosure. So it was a quick, dirty way to raise money. And 504 stock was freely tradable. In other words, it was like registered stock. It wasn't like, it was, in a sense. It existed under an exemption called the provided by Regulation D, Section 504. Now, there were there were some other ones too. You can raise money by selling stock, but you have to follow rules, and in most cases, that stock is restricted. It's Rule 144 stock. So I could raise more than $1 million, but I have to do it on an exemption like Regulation D 505, Regulation D 506, or Regulation A. One of those where there are these carvings out in the Securities Act of 1933, which normally requires these huge disclosures to the SEC. But there are these times when you don't have to make all those disclosures. Like if I'm selling just to filthy rich people, stock to filthy rich people, It would be Rule 144 stock. They can't trade it anyway. And I could get by with that to a certain extent. And I wouldn't have to disclose to hardly anyone. Now, if I want that stock to become freely tradable, most likely the way I do it is on Form 10 later. But I can raise money right away with private stock sales. Okay, but if I, so there are these ways that I can raise money through the sale of common stock. One way, if it's just up to $1 million, I can sell that to anyone through the exemption called Regulation D 504. I can raise more money, but it wouldn't be freely tradable stock to the buyers under other exemptions. So, in other words, I would be selling unregistered securities, but in exempt transactions. 504, I'm selling a registered security in an exempt, a registerable security in an exempt transaction. Now, I brought a couple of companies, sold a couple of $100,000, actually in one case it was like $30,000, raised some money on a Reg D-504 exemption, didn't make any disclosure to the SEC, and then, interestingly enough, later I, just within a matter of a number of weeks, I made the deals with some penny stock houses to start working, trading it. I got it listed on the OTC, in one case I did anyway, right away. But in a case like that, the freely tradable nature of it, it's risky stock. The SEC is not looking at it. The states, some states, I wouldn't even go near them because they're a bunch of assholes. I'll go to the states that were easy. So who's to protect outside investors who might buy that stock in a secondary market on the OTC? That would be where the self-policing organization of the NASD comes in. I can assure you that the lady with whom I worked there at the NASD for some years, her name was Claire, and I believe she has passed on now, she was the bitch from hell. I could pull the wool over state regulators' eyes. I could pull the wool over an SEC regulator's eyes. Claire could smell me a mile away. Hi, Claire. I got a company that I'm trying to get listed. And after she called me about every name that I'd expect from a woman to whom I was married, then we'd work. What I loved about it was that I could just go right back to the company, hey, you've got to give them more information than this. Claire. Well, you just tell her. No, we're going to call Claire. You tell her. No. Well, because they see that, and so the self-policing was there. And so it was a substitute for oversight by regulators at the public level, the federal and the state level. Now, all of that having been said and put aside, let's get to the real public offerings. In this public offering, in public offerings, registered securities in non-exempt transactions, with the regulatory environment established by the Securities and Exchange Commission pursuant to the Securities Act of 1933, that's a mouthful. And you'll probably have to listen to the podcast to get this again. In other words, new issues of stock are the Securities Act of 1933. After the stock has been issued, that would be the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. You see, after the Republicans were kicked out in the 1932 elections, after the extraordinary fiasco of the 20s coming to a crashing halt, this liberal era, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was put in, and they just cracked down. Regulatory agencies, hardcore, tough laws that have pretty much, in many cases, fallen apart or have turned into patchworks in the decades since then. But the Securities Act of 1933 is the set of laws that lays out this is for new off issues of stock. The Securities Exchange Act of 1934 is for stock that exists in its transactions in secondary markets. Now, all these laws are given life through the regulations that are established by the Securities and Exchange Commission. These regulatory agencies are created to oversee securities law, to create regulations to make those laws have effect upon the incumbent businesses. So, for example, antitrust law is overseen by the Federal Trade Commission. That would be the Sherman Act, the Clayton Act, the Federal Trade Commission Act, and amendments like Robinson-Patman, the Chain Store Act. In the case of the Environmental Protection Agency, its job is to oversee and write regulations to animate the laws of environmental law. The FCC is there to oversee laws that govern telecommunications. In most cases, courts leave great latitude to the regulatory agencies. They leave great latitude to the regulatory agencies. Essentially, these are the guys who know the stuff. Many of you could actually work for these regulatory agencies someday. They pay well, and all you have to do is stay for 3 years, and then you'll get a big job in industry, and you'll know how the regulators work, which is unfortunately the way the revolving door has been for far too long, both in regulation and in the military-industrial complex. But that's another story entirely. But here's how it works. Instead of a Form 10 to register the stock, this is going to be new stock that is coming out and is going to be sold to the public. Oftentimes, it's not sold to the public right away. It's sold to a group of investors called the underwriting syndicate, and then the underwriting syndicate dumps it off onto the sucker or the investors. But that's another story I'll get to in a minute. Now, depending upon the type of offering, and it has to do with the size of the offering and the size of the company, and whether it's their first offering or maybe a subsequent offering, the big 800-pound gorilla is the Form S-1. That's a full-blown, no slack, disclose everything, including the freckles on your grandmother's butt, which is really disgusting. I'm sorry I said that. I did one Form S1. It qualified. Now, what happens with this, and I'll tell you right now, it's just this massive disclosure. Have you ever heard of a prospectus? That's what the public gets to read about buying a new stock. The prospectus is one part of that monster Form S1. There's a first part, there's a prospectus, and then there's the last part. The prospectus is the part that you hand out to the public to read while I might buy the stock. But there are other parts to it, too. It's a giant document. I filed, and I knew what was going to happen. I filed Form S-1 for a public offering of stock by a corporation. I got back the deficiency statement. The corporate division at the SEC, they will have someone assigned to look through it, and they'll find all the things that are wrong with your filing. The facts, 496 deficiencies from my initial attempt. I almost had a heart attack. I called an old geezer in the business, and I said, this is it. This is almost 500. He said, not bad. What? And I spent 2 days fixing everything addressing everything. Came back, the second deficiency, 16. Third pass, it's a kind of a sad thing to say. It was the rush of my life. The SEC qualified it, declared the date and everything. Form S-1 qualified. Then we just had to wait for the cooling off period, and then we could do the stock. That's the big 800-pound gorilla. I swear to God I would never do one on my own again as long as I lived. There are other ones, too. There's a Form SB-1 small business offering, and then there's an SB-2. And there are all these other ones, too, that you can file, depending upon how much you're trying to raise, the size of the corporation, whether you've raised money before in public offerings. And there's variations. There's one called a shelf registration, which is one that is very popular with large corporations, where essentially they'll register this monster block of stock, but then they don't have to sell it all right away. What they can do is just, as they need money, they can just pull some of the stock off the shelf and sell that to raise money. It's almost like a revolving credit thing, except it's equity. That's called a shelf registration. Then there are these other ones that are weird. There's one that was big with consultants in my time, and I would not do it, which is why I'm poor at this, to this day. There was an S8, which was really strange. It was a consultant's stock. And there was also a variation on that where you could actually sell stock off to offshore investors who could then bring it back a certain number of days later. No filings. I mean, you could sell huge amounts of stock to drug dealers in the Caribbean. Not that I would do that, mind you. I mean, sell it to investors in Asia. It was the weirdest little twist, that offshore deal. And in the time, that was why I was in the market to buy an offshore bank charter. There was one that I almost bought on the Isle of Man. There was a dead bank, it was chartered, and I could have used that as as essentially a reservoir into which to bring investors' money and then pop this offshore stock there and then just sell it back onto shore into the open public markets later. Freely tradable. It just creeps me out, all the weird things that we did in those times. I'm sure none of that exists anymore. But, okay. These are the different kinds, and there are other variations you might see. But if you go through the Edgar system, they're filed. These filings are through Edgar. You can actually read the S-1 that made a corporation come into a go public. They are there. Now, as far as going public goes, where does the money come from? There are two ways. One way that I never saw it, it was what was called a firm underwriting. There is essentially a big brokerage firm, an underwriting firm out there that will say, yes, we will buy your stock, and then we'll sell it to our clients. That guarantees the company will have a successful underwriting, a successful stock offering. But in exchange, of course, the underwriter will require a flotation cost. That's that F that you saw in the D1 over P0 minus F. And by the way, for God's sake, use D1 instead of D0. Sorry, off topic there. Okay, that was the flotation cost. Now, what will happen is there will be a lead underwriter. That will be the underwriter that says yes. Then that lead underwriter will form a syndicate of other big dog companies or medium-sized dog companies, and they will join. Each one will say, well, four of you, each of you will take 10% of the stock and you'll sell it. Me, the lead underwriter, I'll take 60%. I'll deal with 60% of the stock. But we're going to make the company get its money right away, minus float. Okay? And then the underwriter and the underwriting syndicate sell the stock into the market. So by the time you, as an investor, see that stock, I bought stock in a public offering. No, you didn't. Because the underwriter bought it from the company. And then the underwriter made sure that the underwriter's best clients got the best deals on it. By the time you would have a chance to buy that stock has already gone up in price. The price run-up has already happened on it, if it was going to have a price run-up on IPO. And so you're not going to get any kind of a deal whatsoever. How do you get around that screw-over? Be part of a mutual fund, because mutual funds are oftentimes... if it's a good mutual fund, they're high on the list that the underwriters will call and say, we've got some stock we just underwrote, we needed you to buy it. So there's where you can get your wedge. Don't go in, noobs, and buy stock in an IPO. By the time you get it, it ain't worth anything. Okay, now that's a firm underwriting. Now, I never actually achieved a firm underwriting except in venture capital frameworks, and venture capitalists just took the ass of the corporation. Where the other way is through what's called a best efforts. What sometimes we used to call Western. a Western style offering. Essentially, I would line up some brokers who would say, we'll do our best to sell your stock. No guarantees, but we'll try to sell it. Now, oftentimes, and this was the way I did them in IPOs where I just did it straight up, not private offerings and all that, you had to give these brokerage houses a lot of stock free to get them interested in playing in joining to try to sell stock. So in other words, they'd say, we'll sell 100,000 shares of stock. We'll try to. So give us 200,000. Wait, you said 100,000. That's right, 200,000 shares. So in other words, they wanted 100,000 for themselves. And the argument was that they needed 100,000 to make the market so that they had 100,000 shares in that house so that as buyers came in and sellers and all that, they had an inventory of the security. That was our argument. Of course, it was obvious that they also wanted a buttload of the stock in case it actually the company ever went anywhere. Now, there's one other kind of offering that I don't think they even mention in the textbook because it's a respectable textbook. This is the one we did ourselves, and I did more than a few of these. It's called a self-underwriting. A self-underwriting is when the company tries to sell its own stock. The executives just call, try to sell the stock. Call friends, call family, call uncles you haven't heard from in 20 years. They actually self-underwrite. Now, these were the way a lot of my clients actually got started. I can tell you, weird companies. I had this one company. It sounds like a stupid-ass idea, but it was actually, for a while, it got successful, and it needed money to go bigger. The idea was that they would actually build these houses out of these molds. A mold would shape the house, the walls, and then into this pump, they would pump this special carbon type of material that was like as strong as steel, and that once they pulled the mold off with a crane, there'd be a house. It was the coolest idea, and I saw a bunch of the houses they built like this. They needed more money for more of these because they were starting to get some demand around the country for this stuff. And so we did a self-underwriting on that company. It actually was reasonably successful. They needed about $250,000. We came in at about $200,000 on that deal. That was on a 504, so it was really an exempt registration, but still it was like a self-underwriting. Now, some states did not want self-underwritings. Florida got so nasty with it that they required that any company that did a self-underwriting, it actually had to register and meet all the legal requirements of a brokerage house. I mean, that was the end of Florida. Screw that. We walked away from there. In other cases, it got the worst one I ever saw was in Ohio. And I did work in Ohio, where they got so nasty. There was this company that had existed. It was created by former government people, like CIA people, real tech jocks. And they were doing imaging, and this was in the 1980s, that just blew me away. Three-dimensional holograms. And it had come out of technology from apparently missile tracking system or something like that. But they actually had like a beer can spinning in the air with nothing around it. When I walked into the company this first time, they had me walk into this dark room, and this devil just come flying at me out of nowhere. I almost shit myself. This was so cool. One day, I got a frantic call from the wife of one of the founders that they had been arrested by state highway patrolmen. They apparently had violated some law about selling their own stock. Apparently, one of the guys who was in the company, he was a fireman by trade, but he was also an industrial engineer. And he had created these massive concrete pillars into the ground to keep the stable, these cameras, so that they could do these shots without even the tiniest variation. But apparently, a securities regulator called him on the phone and said, just asking him, well, we got some just easy questions about the self-underwriting. Now, are you using this money for personal gain that you're getting from the sale of these stock? And the guy said, well, we kind of paid ourselves a salary last week for the first time since we started the company. That was it. That was what sent them all to prison. You can't use the stock for the proceeds from a sale of stock like that for personal gain. They used that as a basis. They sent those guys all to prison, and that technology disappeared. Of course, we know very well that technology didn't disappear. I don't know where it went, but I've seen the technology popping up. I saw another technology that was also from that era that had the same thing happen in another state. These guys had developed a system for law enforcement where a judge could sign a search warrant remotely with a special pen, and then there was this machine like in the back of a police van, and it would perfectly replicate the judge's signature on a warrant right there so that if they needed to do a search real fast, coolest-ass technology. And it wasn't just like a photocopy of the signature. It was all the pressures and brush strokes. It was the judge's signature. Same thing happened to these cats. They all went to jail for some arcane securities law violation, and that technology disappeared. But you and I both know that technology is out there. You know those pads you sign on? You think that's photocopying your signature? It's measuring the brush strokes with highly sophisticated mathematical programs. It is figuring out how your hand writes a signature. That is that technology I saw all those years ago. It's the same technology, much more compact now. I mean, these machines back then, they were enormous. It was like a robotic hand that was doing the recreation. But it was a robotic pen that was doing the recreation. But several states had actually already initialized laws saying this was a legitimate judge's signature, even though it wasn't the judge's physical hand that did it. But anyway, this is the story that's behind all of these different equity stories that you hear. When you hear equity, this is the backdrop of it. And you've heard it from someone who actually did this business. But for an exam, I'm going to ask you fairly lightweight stuff. I would ask you for things like what these forms mean, what's the difference between these underwritings is, where you go, what an 8K would be for, and all that kind of stuff, what the bylaws mean. So study this over the weekend and have an enjoyable few days. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.